Seth Price behind us right now. The album is called Army Jacket. We're hearing a track entitled Stag. That was Grimes finishing up the show before that. Visions. She did a pretty funny interview with Nardwar a week or so ago, I think. Track we heard, Symphonia 9, My Weight Is You. Dat Politics before that. Blitz Gazers, a new CD from which we heard Yes Way. Radio Inactive from the Akashic record we heard Mint Tea. Sandy Bull demonstrating the Rhythm Ace live in 1976. Raj Mahal, another project of the dude who is Decimus. Self-titled LP from which we heard a track called Unknown Metals. American Cloud Songs before that, the LP called Ohm. We heard a song called Light on the Path. And Departement, 1985's Le Album. We heard Quelle Chaleur. Bernd Friedman prior to that. Wow, long set. A lot of songs. Boko Boko, the CD, for which we heard Tom Tom Kepo. We heard a great one from Baris Manko called Sakla Samani Galir Zamani. The song we heard, Ganul Dagi. Michael Rother from his solo LP entitled Flamende Herzen. We heard the track Carousel. White Fence and Family / Perfume. The name of the band that gave us Balance Your Heart from Volume 1 and 2. Blue Cheer did Out of Focus from a nicely broken 7-inch B-side to Summer Time Blues. Wild Wild Life have a 2-year-old record new to our bin called Give In to Live. We heard Sour Mirage. We opened that set with one of Robert Smigel's Saturday Night Live animated things, TV Funhouse. The Disney Vaults, taking you into the Disney Vaults. That's everything we heard. Next time I speak to you will be this Friday from the Primavera Sound Festival, Barcelona, España. Looking forward to talking to you from there. Won't see you next Monday. I'm not yet sure who's going to be filling in, but I'm sure it'll be great. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide on the internet at WFMU.org. My name's Scott. See you in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for Benjamin Walker. Too Much Information is next.
I had no idea that this was going to take so long. Really, I thought I was going to meet success at the very first bend in the road. I mean, I've been doing this show for 2 years now, and yet I wear no crown of achievement. I don't even have one of those sun visors with my name printed on the tinted plastic. To tell you the truth, my dear listeners, I was beginning to lose hope. But well, tonight I stand before you at the brink of total and complete success. That's right. Things are really happening here at the Too Much Information HQ. And tonight, my dearest listeners, I have something very special to share with you. Tmiley, the Too Much Information social app. As I've said from the beginning, Too Much Information is a kick-ass name. A name that signifies artistic integrity, intellectual acumen, risk-taking, envelope-pushing, not afraid to go all the way over the edge of edginess. TMI signifies all of these concepts, and it signifies all of them at the same time. And Tmiley, the Too Much Information social app, well, with a name like Tmiley, we venture out even further over the edge of edginess. We speed 3 curves ahead of the curve that everyone else is behind. And we do this with entrepreneurial verve and innovational vim. T-M-I-L-Y. Tmiley, a forward-sounding yet vague enough to be versatile name that makes all kinds of allusions to the trappings of success and winning. Tmiley, the Too Much Information social app. It's the consummation of everything I've been working on for, well, my whole life. It's like taking all of my sh** and putting it in a pile. A pile to which you can now add all of your sh**. And in time, I'll have a gigantic mountain of sh**. And with Tmiley, I will have the power to obstipate this mountain so that it can be streamed, parsed, aggregated, disintermediated, and monetized. T-M-I-L-Y, the Too Much Information social app. But what about you? What does Tmiley have to offer you? Why, it should be obvious. Now, instead of a place you can visit once a week, you'll have a place where you can live. A place I hope that you will come to call home. But Tmiley is not a radio show app. It's a secret garden. A secret garden with walls around it. A garden where all shortcomings and personal failings and inadequacies are pulled from the grounds like weeds and tossed over the wall of the secret garden. T-M-I-L-Y is a sovereign domain. And there's going to be an IPO. Yes, an initial public offering. This Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown. And our consultants have told us that it is extremely possible that this will be the most successful IPO in internet history. But, well, we already know that. We know that our IPO will be successful because we know that Tmiley is what does not come up when you type in your queries into Google or Bing. Tmiley is what you do not find when you stay up all night tumbling. Tmiley is what you don't get when you open those fishy forwarded emails. Tmiley has no buttons to like and no links in. But when we launch Tmiley, the Too Much Information social app next week after our successful IPO, well, everything is going to change. Tmiley will have all the basics, sound files, image files, text files, but with Tmiley, you will have your very own place in the information architecture. Tmiley will be your ISP and your T1 Plus. Tmiley will even be your flash-enhanced HTML5. Tmiley will offer you all the digital accoutrements you would expect to find at the peak of this technological revolution. Mount Olympus. But tarry, my dear listeners, for just a moment. Tarry before you begin your ascent up to the peak. Behold this mountain in all of its glory and all of its splendor. TMILY, the Too Much Information social app. But again, TMILY is not just a monument to technological achievement and personal realization. It is also a testament to financial success. Our internet consultant has informed us that our stock price is apt to quintuple in value during the very first hour of our IPO. So I guess for those of you who really want to cash in on this exciting financial opportunity, I guess you should show up at Forlini's early this Wednesday, say around 8 p.m. This is an investment that has no risk. TMILY is a solid blue plate investment. Putting your money into TMILY will turn your life into one elongated ski resort weekend vacation. Putting your money into TMILY will ensure that your financial future is a future of wealth, more wealth, and even more wealth. TMILY, the Too Much Information social app. It's a full-size orchestra of financial instruments, and the tune they're playing, that's you're in the money. There's simply too much wealth for one person to concentrate on. So come this Wednesday, I'm going to start trickling some of it your way. Our IPO this Wednesday makes it as easy as walking into a bar. And as I've already said, it's a risk-free venture. There are no pyramids to climb, no pitfalls to avoid. This financial well will never run dry, because we all know that I am sitting on top of something that is perhaps the most valuable asset known to man, a non-commercial volunteer podcast. We are talking a cool gajillion dollars. We've researched this whole app thing so thoroughly. We've looked under every pixel. We've examined every bit. We've separated all the zeros from the ones. And we have found the magic key. TMILY, the Too Much Information social app, is going to have stuff. Stuff for sale. Of course, we could go the traditional route. T-shirts, keychains, bumper stickers, hats, pins, book bags, coffee mugs, note card holders. But that would be boring. The TMILY social app enables you to throw down money for stuff that isn't even real. Fake stuff, made up stuff, bogus stuff, even imaginary stuff. TMILY will have it all. But it will only be available through TMILY. This glorious shopping mall will only exist in the clouds. It's a bit mind-boggling, yes, I know. Well, I'd like you to take a step back, if you could. A step back from this shimmering mountain of stuff. I'd like now to tell you about something just as amazing. I'd like to share with you some of TMILY's marketing plans. Allow me to introduce you to Laura Mayer. She's our chief marketing officer here at Too Much Information. She's responsible for our business plans, our marketing strategies, our market carpet bombing initiatives. And she has a few things she'd like to share with you tonight. Laura?
Hello, Benjamin.
So tell us, Laura, how are we going to get the word out? How will we spread the word about TMILY, the Too Much Information social app?
We are going to be doing some truly innovative and special things. While most of today's marketing strategies begin and end with Facebook, we're going back to the basics. We're going to start with a simple, yet never been done before, word of mouth campaign.
How do you mean?
Well, first of all, we are going to fully exploit today's toxic technology. The smartphones, tablets, and laptops the digitati now tote around have become bacterial danger zones. In our IT department, they've built a highway to the danger zone, enabling us to let loose our own patent-pending, genetically engineered, too much information STD. We're talking eye-catching canker sores that will spread like wildfire among the technologically savvy and sexually uninhibited set. And while you might be able to ignore those contextual ads in your email or Facebook timeline, you won't be able to ignore these terrifying, unctuous mouth sores.
Wow.
They are going to get everyone talking. Talking about TMILY. Because once you go viral, there is no cure.
That's good.
We are also going to employ homeless people. Did you hear about the stunt a marketing company pulled at this year's South by Southwest Festival?
No.
Well, a marketing company turned a group of homeless people into walking Wi-Fi hotspots.
Whoa.
Yes, totally amateur. We can and will do much better. We are going to fully embrace this technology, the itinerant homeless hub.
How will that work?
Imagine walking, stalking, pinging telegrams. We have also designed TMILY toupees and prosthetic limbs that we are going to offer free of charge to subway buskers and street musicians, as long as they can sing or perform the TMILY jingle. We are also working with international terrorists who, instead of planting bombs on airplanes, will detonate skywriting devices. What's the weather like? Well, with just a quick glance up at the sky, you'll realize it's tmily out. And we've bred a special flock of homing pigeons who will be taking our message straight to the heads of the people.
This is all very impressive, Laura.
And it's only the beginning of the show. We have electronic signal disruptors installed in 3 satellites now. These satellites will be able to disrupt any electronic device. And I'm not just talking about TVs and radios and computers. I'm talking coffee makers, toaster ovens, electric razors. All of these devices will be able to transmit content from the TMILY social app at ear-splitting decibels and in full color resolution. And, as you know, the next big thing is the 3D printer. Our satellites are ready and primed to transmit to these machines as well. So, you know what that means. The word becoming flesh.
Wow, Laura, wow, this is so impressive.
It's like a full-on biblical plague. And it kicks off Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown at the Too Much Information Social App IPO. See you there, Benjamin.
See you there, Laura. So, my dear listeners, I hope you're getting the picture. I hope that Miss Mayer has illuminated for you that we know what we're doing here at TMI, and that our IPO is the IPO that you've been waiting for, well, your whole life. So mark your calendars now. This Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown, it's the Tmily Too Much Information Social App Initial Public Offering. Come on down and make sure your name gets written in the Book of Light. You don't want to be left out. You don't want to spend the rest of your days wandering around in the dark.
So a few months ago, a project called Tacocopter hit online, and essentially what it was a very realistic-looking website that purported to be a mobile app that would allow you to call an automated robotic drone to your location to deliver a taco of your choice. And of course, the whole project wasn't real at all. It was actually sort of completely vaporware, which is kind of a slang term to refer to a product that actually isn't real. At all, the project itself got sort of enormous amounts of attention. You know, it appeared on the Daily Show, was widely passed around technology blogs, and a lot of people eventually thought that the product was in fact real. And that was hugely inspirational to me and my friend Greg, who decided to put together an event called Hype Up Weekend.
Tim Huang is an internet researcher living in the Bay Area. A few months ago, he and his friend Greg Mara hosted Hype Up Weekend, an event that marks the beginning of a new Silicon Valley movement.
So the idea of this is actually kind of distinct from an event that commonly happens in the tech world called hackathon, essentially where a group of coders get together and they kind of go on a marathon coding sprint for a day or two to produce products. Rather than building anything real, we decided that we'd create an entire hackathon around vaporware, essentially fake products. It would be a competition. The team that was most able to hype their fake product would be the winner at the end. And so rather than spending time on real products, we went straight to ideas and straight to releasing them. Brought together about 20 or 30 people, and we threw around some ideas for the first few hours about what are the kinds of big products we could launch and the sorts of things that would garner a lot of hype. And then we broke up into teams to go ahead and try to launch these products. One of my favorite products that was launched was an application called Scraps, which purported to be a mobile app that would allow you to essentially have an Airbnb for your leftovers. So if you had a half a can of beer and an old pizza that had been sitting in your fridge, you could put it up for people to share. The guy who's behind that product ended up putting together this great, really professional looking slide deck to kind of sell the idea. Another project was called Ditch the Conference, and the idea was actually quite basic, but actually quite good, which is that, you know, most people go to conferences, but they mostly want to party, actually. You know, you often find that panels are really quite boring and you know, people don't really have much to say. So the idea of Ditch the Conference was that professionals could actually hire surrogates to sit in panels for them and take various notes that would be given to them at the end of the conference. Leaving them free to party while the conference is going on and setting them up to kind of deliver their sort of learnings when they finally got back to the office. So the winner of Hype Up Weekend ended up being a company, quote unquote, called Shock Bottoms. And it was really interesting because it actually was not a technology product at all. Essentially, all it was sweatpants with really offensive things on the back, stuff like, you know, Darfur. And the hedge on it was basically that for every Shock Bottom sold, money would be given to charity. And obviously, this was kind of a great troll that was later picked up by a number of prominent blogs. A New York Times columnist, Nick Bilton, has a theory that companies, technology companies in particular, don't really like to have a revenue model because it allows them to project whatever revenue model they'd like. And I think it's possible to take kind of a cynical view of Hype Up Weekend and say that this kind of represents the same thing, but only for products, right? That you don't even need a real product anymore in order to get the attention that you would have as a real company. It turns out that you can produce really professional, realistic-looking technology startups in the course of a few hours with no technical experience and zero talent.
I passed on from this world and found myself before the gates of heaven. But I couldn't afford to get in. I had no money to pay the required entrance fee. So I was forced to camp outside the pearly gates with the thousands of other poor souls who had not a penny to their name. And there were cripples everywhere. You see, the handicap entrance was broken, so there were beggars and cripples everywhere. It was a veritable shanty town. But us beggars and cripples made the best of our situation. There was singing and dancing and congenial merrymaking. And at night, well, at night, things would really swing in our shanty town. We were having so much fun that some of the saints and angels started sneaking out of heaven late at night in order to check our scene out. They were slumming, of course, but they got the party really going. They'd bring us booze and drugs, and they'd pay us money for sexual favors. When you're broke and camped outside the gates of heaven, you are in no position to turn down a chance to make some money. So I began to prostitute myself in the hopes that I could make some fast cash and get myself into heaven. I don't really want to go into the despicable details, but let's just say I took many a beating from that venerable hag, Saint Victoria. And oh, how I suffered at the hands of that seedy little fat man, Saint James the Lesser. I'd even go for rides with the angel Thaddeus in his chariot. This was an extremely stupid and dangerous thing to do, but I needed money, and this was the only way to get it. But I was never able to save any money. I was never able to save a dime. I was slothful and sloppy with my money, and I'd throw it all away on designer drugs and expensive fusion cuisine. But it felt right. It felt right to waste this money that I'd been forced to prostitute myself for. It felt right to waste it all on artisanal heroin. It felt right to waste it all on Kung Pao Pozole Verde. And if I had any money left after my nights of binging and gorging, I'd throw it all away on tchotchkes and knickknacks. I never saved a dime. And I spent quite some time living like this. But then, suddenly one day, the party stopped. The word came down that we were all to be cleared off. The Virgin Mary had disappeared, and us beggars and cripples got the blame. Of course, we had nothing to do with it. My buddy Limpy said that he saw her sneak out the western gate on a motorcycle. But us beggars and cripples took the fall. And the seraphim herded us all up and marched us off into the wastelands of nothingness. And as I march along in this ragtag column of beggars and cripples, the reality of my situation sinks in. It sinks in that I blew it. It sinks in that I will be forever nothing but a beggar, a bum. It sinks in that I am going to spend the rest of eternity in the wastelands of nothingness. This is just too much to bear, and I slump to my knees and I howl with despair. One of the seraphim starts jabbing at me with his spear, yelling at me to get up, but I can't get up. It is all over. I am totally over. And this is where I wake up. I'm completely drenched in sweat. My heart is ticking like a time bomb, and I'm clutching my stuffed elephant. But it was only a dream. I'm not marching off towards the wastelands of nothingness. It was only a dream. And I start to breathe, and my heart slows down, and then TMILY. Tmily, the too much information social app. It all comes back to me. There will be no prostitution. In fact, there's going to be an initial public offering this Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown. And after my IPO, the only thing I'm going to dream about is money. That's right. The Tmily Too Much Information social app can monetize dreams. Tmily can monetize all sorts of things you never thought could be monetized. Ambitions, aspirations, passions, pretensions, flashes of brilliance, flights of fancy, somewhat great notions. The TMILY Too Much Information social app is designed for the monetization of everything, which is why they're already calling our IPO the floater. So come on down to Forlini's Bar in Chinatown this Wednesday night and climb on board. But you have to act now, because the Tmily social app is about to set sail for the tropics of cornucopia. I have T.R. Gutenberg, our chief financial officer, on the phone to tell us more.
Yeah, Benjamin, I'm at the top of the Double Gold, Big Sky Ski Resort. Listen, lately I've been discussing some important and meaningful figures with some attractive and meaningful people. We've reached some meaningful conclusions, which is to say the IPO means a lot and is therefore meaningful for all involved. Personally, I couldn't be more excited. I graduated from college 6 months ago, and I'm still receiving care packages from home. to think that a year ago, I was waiting in less meaningful things like anthropology and synchronized swimming, and a year from now, if not less, we won't be talking about weekend ski excursions anymore, because our lives will more or less be one long ski vacation. There are some very attractive people, if you haven't been, at each and every one of these ski resorts. People with sexy clothes and a very thorough understanding of all the acronyms involved in any IPO. And speaking of acronyms, and this actually is rocket science, so listen up. We've so far gotten down IPO itself as a concept. But before we go much further, we really have to move forward with ADR, NASD, PER, MEP Now, SEC, REIT, DPO, and ZCBS. I mean, essentially what I'm saying, in terms as certain as the slopes and blonde delights at Steamboat, is that we all stand to benefit and we'll all reap the benefits of all the lovelies of the loveliest places, whether it's ski resorts or secluded cottages in France. I have a consequential meeting in a few minutes, emphasis on consequential. But before that, listen to this. Last year, it just so happened that one IPO resulted in its CEO and advisors visiting 42 different ski resorts.
42?
42 different ski resorts in the 2 months following. That's a lot of attractive people to see, and just as important, slopes to ski. But, you know, forget those 42. Forget the 42 slopes altogether. Because there was another public offering last year that allowed more than a few key and meaningful figures to... Holy mother of God, this will be us. Vacation at 79 slopes.
79.
79 slopes. Let's do some quick math. That means approximately a different slope every 4 days. And that's just New England if we're not feeling too adventurous. Though, of course, we sort of have to move with the seasons, don't we? Hey, Europe is cool. Hello, private jet. Fasten your seatbelts. Apparently doing it on jets is very fashionable and fun. Though not as fun. Back to business for just a second here. Is offering up at, say, $250 million on NASDAQ. In which case, you could ostensibly have a child in every country and still float them the monthly check like it's a phone bill. In conclusion, IPO, slopes, attractive IPOs on the slopes, attractive slopes straddling attractive IPOs and CEOs and CFOs, 79 slopes attracting more beauties and bicycles in China offer up on NASDAQ very slopingly and this slope meaningfully the whole wild time. And finally, and conclusively, powder, 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 powder. Oh, holy Christ on the cross, I really have to go. Goodbye!
Enjoy your ride, TR. So, my dear listeners, you see now that this really is the opportunity of a lifetime. The opportunity to take part in something that offers you a fully guaranteed monetization. So join us this Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown for our initial public offering. Ensure your future. Ensure that you will never be herded off into the wastelands of nothingness. Ensure your place in the TMILY Too Much Information social app. But in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you about our naysayers, our scoffers and head nodders. Yes, we do have our critics. TMI Inc. does have its share of contrarians and pessimists. There is indeed an opposition out there, and it's a hostile opposition that would go as far as to have us snuffed out. And this opposition has been making things difficult for us since the very beginning. It's always been lurking there in the shadows, stirring up trouble, inciting riots. It's been one calamitous din, a cacophony of defeat. But come this Wednesday, this churlish opprobrium will be silenced once and for all. So you naysayers and contrarians out there in the radio darkness, listen up. This is your last chance to cross over to the other side. This is your last chance to get on the winning team. TMILY. I've just received a fax from a Carrie Thompson in Oklahoma City. She writes, "How can you ragtag neo-Luddites expect to be players in the technology game? You don't even have a working podcast feed." Well, Carrie, we here at TMILY understand technology. We understand that technology is not fancy gadgets and pretty toys. We here at TMILY understand that technology is actually a relationship between people, and that this relationship predetermines what kinds of gadgets are even possible. It's not the other way around, as those other technological pundits would have you believe. How many gadgets have you purchased because you were made the promise that they would make your life more efficient, more productive? How many gadgets have you bought under the impression that they would automate certain processes in your life? Now ask yourself this question: how many of these gadgets are precisely the reason your life sucks? And you suffer because you never question technology itself. But your suffering is now about to end, because we here at Tmiley have questioned technology. We've asked the big question: what's so great about efficiency and automation to begin with? You don't need me to tell you the answer. You know the answer in your soul. There is absolutely nothing progressive about efficiency and automation. Each step we make on this march of progress takes us further and further away from happiness and freedom. But Tmiley is a totally different technology. Tmiley is a technology where perfect happiness, personal fulfillment, and financial monetization are baked into the app as means, not ends. But how will this technology work? Well, I have here with me tonight Dr. Frank Christoph, our chief technologist here at TMI. He's going to explain to you now exactly how our revolutionary technology is going to work. Dr. Christoph, are you there? Hello? Dr. Christoph? Can you hear me now? Hello?
I'm here, Benjamin. I'm here to tell you about something amazing. Now, we've all heard of science fiction. That is, fiction based on science. Science is the adjective, fiction is the noun. But we here dare to ask the question, what about fiction science? Fiction adjective, science noun. What about fiction technology? Let's explore this exciting paradigm shift. When one reads a science fiction book, he or she imagines all the wonderful things described therein. The reader is transported through the looking glass of perception and lives on the other side for a while. But these images are weak. We need something stronger. We need to go from imagination to full-blown hallucination. Hallucinations are normally brought about by an extreme emotional and physical trauma, and no one wants that. An easier way is with drugs. But these hallucinations, although often pleasant, lack focus, and we need to focus them. We do this by replacing the drug with something better. Fully integrated, programmable neural receptor nanochips.
Uh-huh.
Instead of relying on the low-yield chemical-electric reactions ordinarily found in the neurotransmitter-receptor-neuron system, these babies give a direct electrical impulse to the receptor and neuron. This stronger signal overrides the normal inputs and lets you customize your world. Each neural receptor nanochip will be constantly talking to the others in order to coordinate neuron firings for maximum effectiveness. But they're also talking to someone else. A network of cellular phone boxes, radios, and global positioning satellite systems. All this to ensure that our sovereign domain blends seamlessly with the real world. The person you talk to on the street may seem friendlier, more interested, or better looking, but it will definitely be a person. Even in the extreme, that woolly mammoth barreling down the valley at you, which is actually just a bus coming down 4th Street, will be seen by you at the same distance and velocity, and you'll be able to get out of the way. But Ben, it doesn't stop there. The GPS integrated system can help you in other ways. Want to go to Germany but don't speak or read German? Well, you do now. You'll feel like you're speaking, hearing, and reading English. The nanochips interpret and translate the visual and audio inputs and will reshape your vocal motor system so that when you say, "I'd like a beer, please," it will come out, "Deine Schwester ist eine große Frau."
Wow.
It's amazing. I'm only scratching the surface here, Benjamin. But by joining us here, you'll get to take part in this exciting miracle of fiction technology.
thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Christoph, for taking the time out to speak with us here tonight. So, my dear listeners, there you have it. Fiction technology. The radio darkness doesn't stand a chance. And you have an opportunity to be a part of the process. This Wednesday at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown, the TMILY, Too Much Information Social App, IPO. Perhaps you'd like to speak with our chief technologist, Dr. Christoph, or Dirk Gutenberg, our CFO. They'll both be there, as well as Miss Mayer. The entire staff of TMI will be there, bellies up at the bar. The choice is simple. The wastelands of nothingness or a life of technological bliss. Ski resorts. Don't you want to live the gilded life?
Facebook derives 82% of its revenue from selling ads. That's an enormous amount of money. Actually, most media companies, which are advertising-based, don't derive 82%. They are effectively a sales company. They have to go out like everybody else on Madison Avenue, carry their portfolios around, and pitch advertising agencies. They live and die on whether or not they can convince someone that an ad on Facebook will move the merchandise. It's advanced only to the degree that that Facebook is now, say, social media.
Michael Wolff is an author and a journalist. In his piece for MIT's Technology Review, he boldly predicts that Facebook is not only on course to go bust, but that it will take the rest of the ad-supported web with it.
The fundamental premise of the ad-supported web is that it will be a better advertising medium than traditional media. It will be more focused, more engaged, more responsive, more targeted. Facebook has gone into its IPO making precisely this same argument. But what we now know over the course of 15 years is, in fact, that ads on the web are less successful, not more successful, less successful than ads in traditional media. They command less response, less engagement, are less impactful, and sell fewer products than ads in traditional media. So that's a very big thing. That means that the fundamental assumptions are wrong. Selling ads is a difficult business. It's an odd business. It's an eccentric business. It's often actually a kind of a deceitful business. And it's a business that there are people who are expert at. And it needs an expertise. The Facebook people are not expert at this. Quite the opposite. They are experts at creating technology. But that in no way means that they are equipped to or the best people to have selling advertisements. They have been able to maintain their growth because they get bigger. They're at 800 or 850 million users now. That will go to a billion. That will go to a billion two, a billion four. However, at some point, there aren't any more people with computers. But they've been able to structure their business around falling ad rates and compensating for falling ad rates by having a faster rate of user adaptation. But eventually that will stop, and fundamentally, that's not what they're selling. I mean, even if they continue at the rate they are going, even if that was, if there were an infinite number of people and an infinite number of users, that would not get them to the amount of money they have to make to justify their current stock market valuation. I think that they genuinely do believe that they have a transformative technology, a transformative company, and that they will find some other incredible, heretofore unimagined way to make an enormous amount of money. There's a case that I could make that gives them the benefit of the doubt, except it is based on nothing. And that's the problem here. It is based on the fact that they're smart people, they're incredibly rich people, so that they can buy anything, because technology is transformative, because they have a critical mass of users. So all we have defined is that they are in a good circumstance to invent what they have to invent. But that is still a big leap between actually inventing it. So all we have done, and I think the entire Facebook proposition, is that if anyone is going to do this, we are in the best position to do it. Now, they would not be the first entrepreneurs not to have anything there, but to have bought themselves the time to actually figure it out. But there is only a limited amount of time. You don't have actually even $16 billion worth of time to figure it out. The real problem and the real danger here is that Facebook, because it has so many users, because it has so much space, can keep lowering its price. It can lower its price, and because it keeps getting new users, continue its revenue growth. But one of the effects of that is that it lowers everybody else's price. Now, you could say, well, everybody else is screwed, but Facebook, because it keeps getting new users, will continue to grow up, except for the fact that if everybody else is screwed, the fundamentals of the medium itself are going to come into question, and we will inevitably experience another crash, which will, in turn, bring Facebook down with it.
A couple of weeks ago, I went to this party. It was a party in celebration of somebody's promotion or birthday. I don't recall exactly. I was just tagging along with my friend Kenny. He works for a video game company. He draws all the corporate products and logos you find in the backgrounds in many of today's hottest video games. This party was made up entirely of people who work in advertising. I met people who design viral video campaigns for energy drinks and jalapeno-flavored potato chips, people who write tweets for fast food chains and trendy gadgets, people who manage fan pages for airlines and designer clothing labels, people who write and direct commercials for minivans and SUVs, people who own multiple residences, and people who jet-set all over the world. I tried to make conversation with these people, but they only wanted to talk about themselves and their latest car commercials and hand soap campaigns. They bandied about these incomprehensible acronyms like CPM, ROI, and MePNow. I found myself at a disadvantage. I tried to join this very interesting debate about how today people who work in advertising are now more like artists than artists are like artists. But no one seemed to care what I thought. I couldn't get a word in. All I could do was gesticulate and gasp for breath. But to tell you the truth, there wasn't anyone at this party I wanted to talk to anyway. Well, except for this one woman. This woman with short blonde hair and bright blue eyes. She had on this tight black dress, and there was a little silver and green bag with beaded tassels hanging off her shoulder. Every time I looked in her direction, she would be lighting up a cigarette. And when she inhaled, her whole body bent back. Bag would shimmer in the light. She had delicate fingers and long tapered legs. She was beautiful. But well, I pretty much stuck to the cheese table outside the kitchen. There were cheeses on this table I'd never even heard of. Cheeses with barnyardy aromas and velvety textures. Tastes I'd never before experienced or imagined. The brie had been flown in from a remote village in France just for the party. And this brie was so pillowy, so sharp, I couldn't stop eating it. I even cut off a chunk and wrapped it in a napkin and stuck it into my pocket to take home with me. And then, all of a sudden, the girl in the black dress is at my side. She stares deep into my eyes and then fishes out a cigarette from her little green and silver bag. She lights the cigarette and, blowing the smoke out of the left side of her mouth, asks me, "So what did you do?" I swallow what's left in my wine glass, and then I tell her everything. I tell her all about my theory of how life online is becoming more real than life offline, and how our online selves are draining all the power from our physical selves. I tell her all about my fear that we'll soon be living in a world filled not with people trying to erase unflattering photos of themselves from Facebook, but rather people hiding in terror from their perfectly coiffed and airbrushed digital selves who are armed with sticks and knives. I tell her how the philosophers saw this coming centuries ago. Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, they all knew that if the thing itself ever got rubbed out by the hyped-up thing, then, well, the sh** would hit the fan. I tell her how I'm convinced that the operating system for this hyping of everything is advertising, and how advertising is running a classic bait-and-switch game using the internet as bait. The switch, I tell her, is when the ads all become something not to see, but rather something to be. I tell her how I woke up one morning on the floor with a particularly bad hangover, convinced that it was my duty to tell the world about this coming advertising apocalypse. But unlike John the Baptist, I got bored with the whole apostle thing in a matter of days. And what would be the point anyway? All my friends who used to shout things like "no logo" now scream "brand me" at the top of their lungs. I tell her how I try to stay focused on the big ideas and the big questions, but that I get distracted by flashing cat GIFs, blogs written by ex-girlfriends, and private BitTorrent sites dedicated to obscure animated TV pilots from the 1970s. I tell her all about how I hide out from the internet at the public library. I tell her where my favorite spots are: the art room at the Research Brands, the recording library at Lincoln Center, the comfy sofa next to the plants at the branch on East 9th Street. I do, however, warn her about all the perverts who congregate there, especially that Indian guy with a squeaky shoe who haunts the magazine racks, a guy who, for some reason, makes robot noises every time he spies a disabled person. Tell her how for the past 2 years I've been making a podcast about life in the digital age for the greatest radio station in the world, and how this radio station is one of the last places on earth where there's no advertising whatsoever. I tell her how I've resigned myself to a life without corporate sponsorship, and while it is a life remarkably down market, a life marked more by want and destitution, my tombstone won't be marked with that hateful phrase, "brought to you by." But as I rant and rave this woman becomes extremely uncomfortable. Her beautiful brown eyes begin to furiously dart around the room, and she takes long drags from her cigarette. But I don't get it. I don't stop. In fact, her furtive glances and uncomfortable posture only make me try harder. You see, I've always thought that people liked the story about the bitter, starving artist. I've always thought people loved that story about the man who toils and suffers for his beliefs and principles. But when this beautiful woman begins to frantically light the filter of the cigarette, which is burned down between her fingers, it finally hits me. I was wrong. You see, we Americans are very particular about our stories of hard-working, self-sacrificing people. Yes, of course, we like stories about people who struggle and toil before finally making it big. But the story has to end with a payoff. It's not a good story if the hero doesn't end up in a hot tub filled with money. I mean, let's face it. Those artists who spend their entire lives working stupid, menial jobs because they can't monetize? Nobody wants to hear their stories. Those people make terrible stories. And here I am at this party, unloading my awful story on this poor woman. Shame suddenly overtakes me, and I shove my hands into my pockets and mumble my apologies. I run out the door into the dark of night. There are tears streaming down my face, and I have breeze smeared all over my hands and the front of my pants. But this coming weekend, I am going back to that party. And I'm going to walk up to that beautiful woman, and I'm going to lean in close, and I'm going to whisper into her ear, T-M-I-L-Y. And this Wednesday night, my dear listeners, you have an opportunity to land a leading role in this epic story. Smiley, the Too Much Information social app, IPO. This Wednesday night at Forlini's Bar in Chinatown. Ensure your place in the future. Ensure your place in history. Ensure that your story is a good story. This episode of Too Much Information is called Tmiley. It was written and produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Laura Mayer, T.R. Gilmore, and C. Beck, with assistance from Bill Bowen and Sylvie Kovnat. It also featured Tim Huang and Michael Wolf. You can find even more information on the TMI playlist page, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that and more at WFMU.org.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, interviews with photographer William Jans and rapper Kendrick Lamar. William Jans, photographer, Kendrick Lamar, rapper. Tapper on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU. Who are you?
I am William Jans.
William Jans, you are a photographer. I first met you. Where did I first meet you, actually? I think I first met you because I was a fan, and I kind of can't believe I'm mentioning this, of the band The Cure. And you took photos of The Cure, didn't you?
I think that's right. I think we might have even met at CITR. I think I was a fan of yours listening to your show. And I think, I guess I phoned in one day and won something, and I came out there, and you handed me some CDs. I met you in person, and yeah, you were a celebrity. I got to meet you in person. I've even been wearing a toque for all I can recall.
Well, William Jans, I think that's why I became interested in all the work that you've been doing, because you said, William Jans, I won this prize, and I remembered you took that photo of Robert Smith of The Cure. Could you explain about that? I was like, wow, you took one of these great photos of The Cure.
Well, I probably should say that for quite a few years, I had a great fortune of photographing a lot of bands and a lot of weird places sometimes, which is great fun. And The Cure one, I think shot the gig, and then I also shot an in-store thing they were doing, and Robert Smith was really I definitely shot the gig. I remember the backstage pictures now too, but it was Odyssey Imports where he was kind enough to pose and did this little thing of like pushing his cheeks up like he was forcing a smile, and it was quite a fun little shot. And I think Discorder ran it at the time, and
yes, it was a cover of Discorder magazine. So like, wow, I'm meeting a photographer that took a photo of Robert Smith at Odyssey Records at an in-store.
And a matter of fact, at the time, oh my God, his name's going to elude me at the moment, but the guy who went on quite shortly after to start Network Records was the store manager at the time too. You'll remember his name,
Terry McBride.
Terry McBride, yes.
Off the wall in China, some strange things happen to you in general, don't they, William Jans? Could you please explain, like, the photo lab thingy that happened to you years ago to this China couch surfing thing that happened to you? Coincidences.
I've had my share of almost impossible, well, not almost, utterly impossible coincidences, and about 20 of them have happened to me, and the first one you're referring to is probably still, I think, the wildest one that I've heard, and the funny thing was I even had it told back to me once at a party by a total stranger, and I was able to hear the story and say, yeah, that was me. And he's like, no. I said, no, it really was. And that was where I was overseas and kind of participating in what was the Thai New Year's Festival where they splash water on people. And I came back and I was working at a photo lab in Vancouver a year and a half later, and I was processing film, as I always would, and occasionally I'd see places I'd been before, tell coworkers. This time around, I see pictures of this festival, which I thought was this year's festival, the Water Splashing Festival, and tell a few coworkers, hey, I was at something like this, and as I'm processing them, the prints got wrinkled, so I had to flip the prints over, look at the corrections on the back, and reprint them, and while doing so, found three pictures taken of me without my knowledge halfway around the world a year and a half earlier, which is pretty freaking impossible odds, and even if it went through any of the other staff, they wouldn't have seen it. If the prints didn't get wrinkled, I wouldn't have seen it, and I now have one of those pictures on my wall, and that's probably my weirdest story, but I've got two other ones that happened in this trip. One I'll explain in the show, because it involves four countries in a coincidence, but the trippy one that really, I think, a lot of people have taken interest in, it was the idea of trying to do some couch surfing, which is that website where you can link up with people and say, hey, basically, can I crash on your floor, or something like that, and I joined in the Philippines, and the only city I thought I could pull this off in was called Xi'an in China, population 8.23 million people, and so I put a note of this woman's name on my computer thinking I should send a note, but I don't know what to say right now, and time ticked on. Eventually, I was 3 hours from the city and was thinking of sending a note, and I thought, yeah, it's just rude to ask 3 hours before you arrive of, hey, can I sleep on your sofa? So I didn't bother. Ends up, I took the bus in, got off at they dumped you at the train station area, which is utter mayhem, super populated and busy. And there's a McDonald's across the street called Mai Dao Lao is what they call it there. And that is a great place to get free water. So I go in, get my free water, and I hear English voices, which you also don't hear often in China. So I wander over to these three total strangers with my little map book, and I'm just saying, hey, I just arrived. Can I trouble you to tell me which way is north? And as they're giving me directions, I kind of look at the one woman, and I said, yeah, this might sound strange, but you're not Rachel Marr, are you? And she says, yes. It was indeed the very woman that I was considering emailing. And so the odds of that are 1 in 8.23 million. So I think I won my little lottery there. And of course, I did have to connect up with her and sleep on the floor, and it's all part of the show and the stories.
Just some of the little tidbits from Off the Wall in China. William Jantz, when you go to China, do you still bring your secret weapon? What's your secret weapon?
I have no idea. What is my secret weapon?
It's a picture, isn't it?
Wow, that's funny. You're talking about, man, you've got a really good memory for this stuff. Yeah, no, I didn't bring it this time. I've had the good fortune. I both was the Dalai Lama's photographer for when he was here one time, so I've got a photo of me and he, but that does not go over well in China. So, I didn't really do much with that at all. But I actually have had the interesting experience of photographing some of the bigwigs in China before, too, with a corporate client that I work with a lot. And one was number two in China at the time, and one was number seven, who... This number seven guy has gone on to be the guy who kind of coordinated all the Beijing Olympics. And yes, I did bring that photo this time. And I didn't really do much with it except in Wangfujing, which is the area where you can eat crazy meats that I'll tell you about in a sec if you want. But I actually pulled it out there to show somebody, and they're like, whoa, no. Because, yeah, he's an important guy. But it doesn't really have much of an effect. I think when I first brought that into China, when I was doing the Tibet trip.
Well, maybe you can explain a picture of you and this Chinese president guy, and when you get in trouble, you flash it, and then you're immediately not in trouble. Right?
No. See, that was what I thought it might work like, but as it turns out, the very first time I ever showed it was crossing the border into China from Laos, and I thought, hey, this would be kind of cool, but the problem was they saw this picture and were, like, panicking, thinking, oh my gosh, how important is this Laowai, this white guy? Like, what do we need to do? Who do we call? And I was thinking, no, that's not what I'm looking for. I just kind of thought they might kind of cut me a bit more courtesy or be nicer or let me through quicker, but everything's very bureaucratic and officious there, so it would have opened up more problems. Like, they thought, oh, you know, who do we call? It was like, nobody. So I really didn't show it much more except to just joke you public on the street.
You were drinking blood and having some spinal cord action like death metal guys, weren't you?
Well, I don't know if death metal guys are known for eating spinal cord, but yeah, I ate some spinal cord. It was horrible. That was with the Maasai. And, yeah, they actually killed a goat for me, which is quite the honor, but it's a challenging experience because it all happens right in front of you. And, barbecued it up. And the spinal cord, originally, I actually wasn't supposed to be eating because that is the best part, and it's saved for the elders. And so the warriors don't get to eat this stuff. But the next morning, they kindly offered me some of this stuff.